Welcome to UBS On Air. Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here, and thank you for joining us. So as the global economy continues to evolve and adapt in accordance with emerging trends and behaviors of individuals, businesses, and governments, it is important to take a step back and understand how avoiding prejudice in those contexts is so critical to achieving economic success. So joining me for the conversation today and for a closer look into this topic, pleased to welcome back Paul Donovan. Paul is the Chief Economist for UBS Global Wealth Management. So, Paul, as always, it's great to be with you, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me back on, Dan.
Paul, first off, I would like to congratulate you on the completion of your recent book, written in a personal capacity. The book is Profit and Prejudice, which takes us through the relationship between economic success and prejudice in labor markets, and will serve as a key point of reference during our conversation today. So, Paul, I know we want to spend some time digging into the findings and implications and calls for action all outlined within your book. Perhaps as a starting point, though, Paul, I'll simply ask you what the genesis, inspiration, motivation was for you to write about this topic, seeing as how you're a white, middle-aged man.
Yes, it's, you know, in many ways, I'm not perhaps a natural target for prejudice. I started writing about prejudice almost 10 years ago at UBS when we were thinking about longer-term trends in growth and what might be driving that. And this was before sort of the fourth industrial revolution had really sort of kicked off as a concept. But it was very, very clear that prejudice was starting to have quite a big impact on long-term trend rates of growth. And then from that, we got a lot more involved as an organization in the issues around marriage equality, and I wrote on the economics of that. And that sort of really sort of fueled the interest. But despite the fact that, you know, as you said, you know, a white middle-aged male, you know, why am I writing about prejudice? I mean, my family history, my personal history, has been bound up in prejudice. But even in my lifetime in London, you would see signs which said "No Irish," and someone from my family background with Irish ancestry would not be welcome in certain parts of London, in certain boarding houses or pubs, because of, you know, the Irish surname, for example. And for my grandparents' generation growing up in the East End of London, this was a time when the family was subject to prejudice as Irish immigrants, but also some parts of my family participated in prejudice, because in the upheaval of the 1930s and the economic changes of the 1930s, they were suffering economically as working class dock workers in East London. And they were lashing out. They were looking for someone to blame. And they were looking for a scapegoat. It's what we call scapegoat economics. And it's very easy to start targeting immigrants or other minority groups in that set of circumstances and use that as a way to feel better about yourself and the economic difficulties you're facing. And so when I was writing the book, and when I've been writing research on this, reflecting on my family history and how periods of economic change in the past have encouraged prejudice and how that has been so destructive, was really a catalyst to look at this whole subject in a lot more depth.
Well, Paul, appreciate that look into your personal and family background and for putting into context the inspiration for writing on this topic of prejudice and how destructive it is on both a human and economic level. I do want to reference one of the points you made earlier, that being on the fourth industrial revolution. What exactly are we talking about there?
So this is sort of a catch-all term for a lot of structural change that's going on. So this is robotics, it's artificial intelligence, it's digitization, the fact that you can stream movies now, all this kind of thing. And the point about this is that the fourth industrial revolution, a lot of the attention is perhaps naturally focused on the technology. And we've seen this in the past, in the first revolution, which was back in the late 1700s, the second revolution in the late 1800s or the third revolution in the 1960s and 1970s, you know, people get very, very excited about the technology because it's new and it's dramatic and it's really interesting. But actually, the whole point about an industrial revolution is that the technology is the least important part of the process. It's how we use the technology that becomes so important. And what happens here is that society changes, the way we interact changes. And we're seeing that with the fourth industrial revolution, which I would argue the pandemic has accelerated in many ways. So the shift to working from home, that changes real estate demand, it changes investment patterns, it changes how we consume food, changes how we interact with other people. It's a whole host of ripple effects coming from this one thing, working from home. The technology aspect of this is, you know, a headset and a webcam and a laptop. So the technology is actually quite small, but the implications of that explode out. And that's what makes industrial revolutions so fascinating, but also so dangerous. Because, of course, it's all of this upheaval, all of this disruption, which causes people to be very nervous and to worry about their futures and causes this anxiety, which, you know, is such a big part of where we're going.
So, Paul, just there, you outlined some pretty drastic changes as it relates to the kind of impact technology is having on our everyday lives and the change technology drives across various components of the global economy. So, Paul, why does change lead to prejudice and why is it potentially getting worse now?
So this is a very good question. So the problem here is that the world, as we know, is a complex place. And it's getting more and more complex as time goes on. And so the problem is when confronted by complexity, very often we sort of cling to a nice simple solution, sometimes called a rule of thumb. You know, well, I can't be bothered with all this complexity. No, let's just use a simple rule to assess what things are doing at the moment. Now, when we've got the sort of complexity that we're looking at now with this structural change, there are a number of risks that come out of this. So the main risk in the labor market is that you will see jobs disappear. Now, overall, jobs don't disappear. Everyone worries about this every time we have structural change, and it never happens, and I'm absolutely certain it won't happen this time. But what you get is certain jobs disappear and new jobs are created. And if your skill set is not able to transfer to the new jobs, if you haven't got the right skills to do the new jobs, or if you think the new jobs are beneath you, you know, it's, I'm not going to do that, that's not work for a skilled laborer, for example, then you don't see people transferring across. And what you find then is that people lose their jobs, they lose income, they lose social status. And in that situation, what makes it even worse is at the moment that you are losing your income or social status, your neighbor may be getting a rising income or rising social status because, you know, they are working in a part of the economy that is dynamic and is able to exploit the changes, and you're working in a dying part of the economy. Now, when you get that sort of situation, and it's driven by these vast, complex forces that you struggle to understand, it is natural to try and find a simple solution. And the very simple solution all too often is for people to say, well, it's not my fault I lost my job. And of course it isn't. You've done your job to the best of your ability. You've turned up for work every day, been a reliable employee. It's not in that sense your fault. It's the universe has changed. And so you then say, well, if it's not my fault, it must be somebody else's. And then you look for someone to blame, and that's the scapegoat economics coming in. And you say, well, it's not my fault, it must be that immigrant, or it must be that racial minority, or it must be women entering the workforce, which was a big argument in the 1970s and 1980s. And so that's the tendency you get. And then from that, you get prejudice politics coming in. And this is where politicians exploit the process. They very often will use restorative nostalgia, it's called, saying, look, things were better in the past, so let's go back to the past. What's gone wrong? Well, you're quite right. That immigrant did take your job, so therefore let's ban immigration or work on removing women from the workforce or whatever it happens to be. And then you create this irrational prejudice in society by falsely telling people that this will make their lives better. And so when we get this disruptive change, sadly, all too often, it is accompanied by a rise in prejudice, targeting of minority groups, and so forth. And it's an understandable but wholly incorrect reaction to the process of change that we are seeing in a very complicated world.
Paul, avoiding prejudice seems clearly critical to achieving, in part, economic success. Paul, why is prejudice and avoiding forward thinking so damaging, and in particular during the current environment in which we all live in?
The damage of prejudice has been known about economically for almost 70 years now. Gary Becker, a very famous economist in the United States, was writing about this in the 1950s. And the problem with prejudice is that you are essentially putting the wrong person in the wrong job at the wrong time. Because if you are saying to somebody, yes, you're brilliant, you're the exactly perfect person for this job, but you're a woman, so we're not going to employ you. Or you're an immigrant, so we don't want to hear about you. That is irrationality coming to the fore. And you are deliberately not using the best possible person that you can use. And so inevitably there is an economic cost for that, whether it's an individual firm doing this or whether it's society at large being prejudiced and creating this environment. So you automatically get that negative cost coming through right there. We also, however, have a second issue that comes from prejudice, which is just as economically damaging. Because if you are engaged in prejudice, the chances are you are going to have decision-making groups that all think the same way, that all behave in the same direction, that you know, don't have outside different experiences. And if you've got that monoculture coming through, then you're not going to see all the different sides of a problem. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to have errors coming into your decision-making process. Your decisions are going to be poor quality. So not only have you got the wrong people in the jobs, but the decisions that your management is making is also flawed. So this is you know, a real double negative. And both of these things are becoming increasingly damaging in the process of structural change that we've got at the moment. Because, as I said earlier, when we're looking at an industrial revolution, it's not the technology. It's what you do with the technology that matters. That's what really gives you the huge economic success. So you must have the right person in the right job at the right time to make the best possible use of the technology to maximize your success. If you can't achieve that, then you're going to start on a road to economic failure. And then because so much is changing in the world, if you've got a monoculture, if you're not examining the changing world from every possible angle, you are going to miss opportunities for profit. And equally concerning, you're going to miss risks that could prove fatal to your business. So because of the dramatic change, we really have to try and control prejudice as much as possible, introduce diversity of thinking, have people challenge one another in decision making, and make sure that we are employing people based on merit and not on irrational, irrelevant prejudices that skew our hiring decisions.
Paul, we've touched on governments and to an extent individuals in terms of the role that business should play, multinational organizations, private enterprise. Should firms get involved in this arena? And should we not just be concentrating awareness and efforts on clients and shareholders?
I think that firms not only have to play a role, I think firms will probably have to play the leading role in this situation. So we have here two levels. You know, we have prejudice within the firm. Well, prejudice within a firm is clearly economically destructive. And so therefore, it is in the interest of a firm, even if we just think in pure profit maximization, it is in the interest of a firm to eradicate prejudice within its own workforce to the very best of its ability. But if you are a firm without prejudice, but you are operating in a society with prejudice, which treats one group as being less than another group or something like that, you are also going to suffer as a consequence of prejudice in society. It will be a clear negative for you because you may not be able to hire the best person for the job because that best person was never able to get the education that their skills demanded. And so you have wasted talent coming through as a result. Or you may have somebody that you want to move to a different part of the country, to run part of your business, say. But because of prejudice that exists there, you can't ask that person to move because their life outside of work would be impossible. We had this prior to marriage equality in the United States. As as a large company with extensive offices around the United States, we couldn't move some of our employees where we wanted to in the United States because their legal rights as a married couple, as parents of children, would not be recognized had we moved them. And that, of course, creates this problem. So I think the firms do have a very leading role to play here to make it very clear that not just within the firm, but within society at large, prejudice is very costly, and it is detrimental to the overall standard of living that we would all like to enjoy. Sometimes I hear, firms should just not have an opinion on social matters. They should stay neutral. But the problem with staying neutral is that you're not then really tackling what is damaging your business, and that is important. There's a great quote from Archbishop Desmond Tutu, which is, if an elephant is standing on the tail of the mouse will not thank you for being neutral. And that's really what we're talking about with prejudice, that we can't sort of take a neutral position on this and say, no, we just won't have an opinion. The only valid economic opinion for a firm to have is treating one group in society as being worth less than another group is just bad for business, bad for economics. So aside from the social and moral implications, I think firms have got a very firm foundation to be making this case on.
Paul, as a follow-up, can you magnify for us the rewards of removing prejudice in an organization? What kinds of doors does that open up, and what kind of opportunity does the elimination of prejudice create?
Well, if you eliminate prejudice, you're doing a number of things, and particularly if you're a company like UBS, for example, which is very, very dependent on what economists call human capital, the skills of its workforce. Because what prejudice does, it's not just that you're not employing the right people. It's not just that you're missing opportunities or missing risks by not having an intelligent, challenging discussion about decision making. You're also demotivating people. If you've got a culture of prejudice, then people will say, well, I'm not going to bother trying my hardest because I know I'm not going to get promoted because there's irrational discrimination against me, for example. You, as a prejudice company, would be risking not hiring people. People just wouldn't even consider applying to you. And not even necessarily the targets of prejudice. Because very often, if you've got prejudice in an organization, then what will happen is somebody who's not directly target for prejudice but might be a target for prejudice will say, actually, well, I could be next. So I'm not going to go and risk working for them because I could be next. So if you see a firm which has prejudice over sexuality, let's say, and you are from a racial minority, you might say, well, if they're targeting people for their sexuality, maybe they're going to start targeting people for race next. I'm not going to go and work in that environment. That doesn't share my values. I don't want to be doing that. There is a fantastic example in the United States from baseball. In the 1940s and the 1950s, which show really the cost of having prejudice in an industry which is entirely dependent on the skills of its workforce. So when baseball racially desegregated in the mid-1940s, a number of firms went and hired African-American players. And a number of firms remained completely segregated, and it was essentially white-only players for those firms. And the firms which integrated outperformed across the board. They outperformed in terms of the games. They outperformed in terms of the number of spectators. They outperformed in terms of the profitability because they were getting the best possible players that they could get. And the segregated firms were throwing away the opportunity to employ the best possible players. And this, of course, emphasizes the other point, that if one group of firms is saying, well, we're going to be prejudiced, we're not going to employ the best possible people, well, your competitors are just going to go out and hire them, provided they've avoided the error of your prejudice. And that then gives you a double disadvantage. Not only are you failing to attract the talent that you need, you are, as it were, deliberately pushing that talent towards your competitors. Hardly a winning strategy for any business.
Paul, as we're beginning to come to the end of our time together, one final question I would like to ask you, and perhaps this is very much a call for action. What can we as individuals, what can we as investors do to stop prejudice?
So this is a very good question, Dan. And I have to say, the writing the book took about 5 years, and there were times when it was a deeply depressing experience. Because you're hearing about more and more prejudice, more and more extremism, polarization of views, and it does become negative. But there is a lot of grounds for optimism as well. There are things that we can see. So education, I think, is very important. And this comes, I think, in two ways. Firstly, I think that if we educate people correctly, and not just at school. I mean, education is something which takes place throughout our lifetimes. But if we educate people correctly, we can help them be more flexible in the workforce. So if you are working for an industry which is in decline as a result of this structural change, you have the education to be flexible enough to adapt, to find something else to do. Say, well, okay, these skills are no longer relevant, but these skills still matter. And therefore, I'm going to go off and work on this section and so forth. And in that sense, you then don't get the relative decline in status and income, which so often encourages prejudice. So there's that aspect. Second, I think just educating ourselves about people who are different, because it's very often ignorance that fuels prejudice. If you understand the perspective of people who are different from you, that can be enormously helpful, enormously beneficial in reducing prejudice overall. I think narrative economics, telling stories, explaining things with real-world examples is also very helpful. The negative nature of prejudice to an economist is blindingly obvious. But what do? We dress it up in fancy jargon and complex mathematical equations, and nobody listens to us. We've got to get a lot better at clearly communicating with real-world examples where prejudice does damage and why it's so economically destructive. Everyone can understand economics. You know, we all make economic decisions all of the time. We economists need to be a lot better at communicating the consequences of prejudice, certainly a lot better than we have been to date. I think encouraging contact between different groups. There's a theory called contact theory, which says that prejudice declines as soon as you know somebody from a different group. That's because you realize that actually they're human just like you, and they've got the same sort of hopes and fears and ambitions that you've got. And that significantly reduces prejudice. We've seen this in countless examples in the US and Europe over the last 100 years. Contact dramatically reduces prejudice. Now, one of the interesting things here is that technology might help in this regard, because you have an ability now to have contact with a far more diverse group of people through technology, either through direct interaction, through online gaming or chat rooms or shared interests, or through listening to podcasts or watching YouTube channels. You know, we've got a lot more access to different cultures and to forming friendships, even if virtual friendships, with people from very, very different backgrounds. And that, I think, is helpful. I think we also need to challenge prejudice when we come across it. you know, now being British, I mean, the British don't like challenge as a general rule. If we see something we disapprove of, you know, we might tut audibly, but that's about as far as it goes. But that's not enough. You've got to challenge people when they are prejudiced. There's a former colleague who I quote in the book who has this great line about making people feel a little bit uncomfortable. And if you're making somebody feel a little bit uncomfortable, what you are doing is forcing them to confront their prejudice, to question whether, you know, perhaps they are not as inclusive or diverse as they thought they were. And that, I think, is enormously powerful in helping to challenge and reduce prejudice over time. So challenging, I think, is also very, very helpful. There is always a debate about quotas, and quotas are a very controversial issue. A lot of people think that quotas is the only way that we can break some of the unconscious bias and so forth. My own view, and I fully recognize that there will be many people who disagree with this, my own view is that quotas themselves are potentially damaging because, in the first place, it may just encourage more prejudice. Oh, they only got their job to fill a quota. I mean, that's not helpful. It just encourages irrationality and fails to reward people for their very real achievements. So I think that is problematic. And also with quotas, you can still end up with a monoculture of thinking. You might say, okay, right, we're going to have gender diversity, 50% female, 50% male. But if everybody in that group has come from exactly the same social background, educational background, racial background, the fact that you filled your quota doesn't give you diversity. It gives you a monoculture because everyone's still thinking the same. So quotas can be a little bit seductive in that sense and not necessarily helpful. But I think there is a compromise. And when we look at quotas, perhaps having quotas for applications for a job. You know, if you've got a diverse interview pool, that then does increase the diversity of the people that you hire, but you're not forcing it on at that final stage. You're saying, no, at the interview pool, we want diversity, and after that, it's pure meritocracy. Well, that actually can be extremely helpful in creating diversity, forcing people to challenge their biases, forcing people to feel a little bit uncomfortable, but create that diversity in the workforce. So there are lots of things that we can all do, I think, to challenge prejudice. And I certainly hope that it's things that we will be doing in the months and years ahead. The structural change that we're going to be seeing is likely to increase prejudice. It has done in every previous period of structural upheaval. But if we are going to be economically successful, either as companies or as countries, fighting prejudice has got to be, I think, our top priority. The world is a very complex place. The situation that we are confronting is undoubtedly going to be very stressful and complex. But ultimately, the message we need to get across is pretty simple. Prejudice is bad for business and the economy.
Well, Paul, very eye-opening and valuable takeaways you left us with. It has been terrific catching up with you, and thank you again for your passion and your time for bringing this important topic to the forefront of our minds. And I'm sure that this conversation, Paul, will continue as there is clearly still much work to do and progress to be made on this front. And again, Paul, I do want to congratulate you on the completion of your recent book, again, written in a personal capacity. Profit and Prejudice is the title, which dives much deeper into the important topics that you covered with our listeners today. But Paul, hope we can have some follow-up conversations and look forward to having you join us again on the podcast soon.
Thank you very much indeed, Dan, and thanks for such interesting questions.
Thank you, Paul. And again, today we have been joined by Paul Donovan. Paul is the chief economist for UBS Global Wealth Management. From UBS On Air Studios in New York, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.